a guy who drives it through.
Hit the high notes on the park. That's how we became a great team together, you know. It was just unfortunate we never won anything.
Men's in trouble, there's Steve Kirk. The super sub has done it again, and Motherwell are back in front.
Without supporters, you cannot play a game. They are a very, very important part of the club.
Jukovic on the chase, might get there. Handel is with it. Jukovic!
I remember it to this day. It was unbelievable, and that's another reason I love going back to Fir Park, because you do get to interact with the supporters again, who were wonderful for me.
Chance here for Motherwell. This is Pettigrew, outnumbered though. Still has it. Chance of a lifetime for Pettigrew, and it is there!
Yeah, obviously being on the podcast is everything I've dreamed of.
Goes through the middle though, Marvin Johnson. Defenders backing off. Took a deflection! And it goes! Misjudged by Bell! Fir Park! Twisting! Shouting! Shaking!
Good evening and welcome to the MFC podcast. Unfortunately, Sparra can't be with us this evening, so it's down to me, Jay, to try and host and try and steer us through it. I'm joined as usual by Buster and also lending in his company tonight as expert pundit Joe McKelvey. How we doing, lads?
Hi, good, thanks, mate.
Very good, thank you.
Well, obviously we're recording on the Thursday, so last night at Celtic Park still fresh in the memory, but we'll start on a wee bit more of a positive note. Kilmarnock away on Saturday, opening game of the season. You know, a good performance for the most part, a good result. Last 10-15 minutes, maybe a little bit, you know, a little bit dodgy, a few nerves creeping in. But Buster, as far as an opening game of the season goes, you can't really ask more than a win.
That's exactly it. As you says, it seemed a reasonably good performance. 3 points on the board. We scored two very good goals. Lionel's was a great wee chip, and it was good to get a goal after maybe what 30 seconds of the restart. So, as you say, it was pleasing. It wasn't, you know, a magnificent performance, but there was no real reason to think that, you know, we won't do okay this season. We lost a late goal, as you says, and then the last 5-10 minutes, a bit ropey, but, you know, 3 points in the opening day, you can't complain.
Well, that's it. I mean, Joe, obviously, Buster picked up on, you know, the goals, particularly Lionel Ainsworth. I noticed, I think after the game, on the likes of Steelmen Online, although he was getting a lot of plaudits for his goal itself, there was, you know, perhaps the usual kind of split in the Motherwell support, some saying that other than that he didn't do much else, other folk, you know, complimenting him in a decent game. I noticed afterwards he also, I think he was quoted as saying, "I feel amazing," which is obviously a million miles away from his reaction after, you know, Thistle away last season. I mean, how important is Lionel Ainsworth going to be this season, Joe? And, you know, where do you stand? How good was he on Saturday?
Well, first of all, I thought he scored a terrific goal, as you've mentioned. It was a really difficult technique to perfect that. What I will say is I didn't give him as much credit for it at the game until I seen it back on the highlights. At the game, I thought, oh no, what's he done that for? And then I just sort of seen it kind of falling into the net. And then the kind of euphoria of scoring made me not really appreciate it. Then I seen it back at night and I thought, wow, that was a great strike. But I thought he had a good game on Saturday. I mean, I've been critical of him at times when he's been in and out games and when he doesn't look like he's got the best attitude. But I thought he used the ball really well. I thought he kind of, him, Johnson and Cadden all kind of interchanged positions quite well. Ainsworth used the ball quite well, sort of in the number 10 role, if you like, a fair bit. And I mean, people might criticise the miss he had, but I thought that was was a more difficult shot than what it actually looked. So I was actually pleased with how Ainsworth performed on Saturday. I thought he was deserving his ovation when he went off. And I think this season, he said he felt amazing after it. If we have an on-song, on-confidence Lionel Ainsworth, then especially if we do lose Marvin Johnson, it could be pivotal to us doing well this season.
So I take it you think that Ainsworth is here for the season. I know during the summer there was rumours surrounding, you know, his future at the club. He seemed, you know, a few comments seemed to suggest he was maybe going to be surplus to requirements. Maybe McGee didn't quite rate him. And yet, you know, I don't think there's been any players who have played quite as much as Lionel Ainsworth has, you know, since the pre-season friendlies kicked off. And of course, although he didn't start last night, he obviously came on at half time. So, I mean, do you think that there's absolutely no question that he's going to be here for the season?
I highly doubt anyone can for him, to be honest. That's one way to look at it. Especially if Johnson's going. Obviously, we've not received a bid that's anywhere near acceptable for Johnson yet, but the Cubs do seem to be putting him in the shop window, which, incidentally, I do approve of us doing. But to lose both of them out of the squad, for me, would be pretty drastic for us. I see Ainsworth as a player who can have a big contribution and will have a big contribution if we use him effectively this season. And the fact that the thought of losing them both, coupled with the fact that watching Dom Thomas against Steve Stirling told me, as a winger, he's not ready to step up, it would leave a gaping hole in our squad if we were to lose those two. And being perfectly honest with you, if I think Ainsworth was going to be the partners in this window anyway, he would have done so by now. He's played a lot in pre-season, as you say. That might be down to the fact that some of our forward-thinking players like Moult and Blythe have been struggling with injuries, and McDonald started training a bit later than the rest and maybe wasn't up to speed. But he does seem to be in the plans, and I dithered over it in the summer when there was question of him leaving and question of him staying. What I wanted to do, if it was last season, and last season when he didn't get much game time, he was on the bench continually, it was maybe a big wage to have not in your starting 11, but as things have progressed this summer, I think I really would like to see him stay, at least for this window, probably to the end of the season.
No, I think I'd agree with that. I think we've obviously mentioned Johnson, we've mentioned Ainsworth, the two goal scorers. I think a big plus point for me on Saturday was the new signings. I thought, you know, Tate, Hennigan, McHugh in particular in the middle of the park. You know, Clay, obviously at the time, wasn't necessarily a new signing, but we'll come on to that in a wee while. I thought all the new signings, you know, fitted in well. They all played particularly well. Surely that's a big encouragement, Buster, that, you know, our recruitment during the summer, particularly for some key areas, seems to have at least paid off.
Yeah, as you says, I was particularly impressed with Hennigan, to be honest with you, on Saturday. The amount of times, you know, he won the ball pretty easily in the air, you know, it looks as if it's, you know, it comes naturally. I mean, obviously, it helps that he's, what, 6'9" or something, you know, but he's winning the headers, no bother. He's he looks pretty nifty as well. He doesn't look as if he's going to be too smart on the ball. He knows what he's to do with it, basically. McHugh in the midfield as well was, again, looking as if he was a good player. Unfortunate, you know, he didn't crack his skull, sorry, but it's unfortunate that he's, you know, basically ended up with a big gash in his head and missed out on Wednesday as well. But Richard Tate, again, looked pretty comfortable. I've not really seen anything too flashy from him, but, you know, as you say, up until maybe Wednesday, he hadn't really made any bad decisions. So it was good to see, as you say, the new players all seem to be settled in, and they can only really get better for there, I hope.
Yeah, I'm cautious and wary of the fact that, you know, laying praise at some of the new signings that we'll probably end up slating when we come on to Wednesday's game. But, you know, you mentioned McHugh there. I think it was quite telling that when you look back at the game, when we started to struggle, I know during the game and even afterwards, there was chat about it being typical Motherwell, you know, the usual, we can see the goal, we start getting a bit shaky. But surely a lot of that had to be with McHugh going off, because, you know, suddenly there was nobody really protecting the back four. And you know, you would think that kind of highlights just how important he was on Saturday.
I think you're right there. Without looking it up, I think the timeline of his injury was probably about 65 minutes, maybe 60, 65 minutes. I think they scored about 10 minutes to go, and it's you know, they weren't completely on top of us all at that point. It was maybe only, as I say, the last 10 minutes that they had quite a lot of the ball and putting us under a wee bit of pressure. But I think his absence was telling, as you say. You know, there was nobody there, as you say, to protect the back four. I don't think MD, who was in the team at that point, made any, you know, terrible mistakes or anything, but it was just we just seemed a bit less comfortable than we were, you know, half an hour before that.
We'll move on to the, you know, the man in the middle on Saturday. Apparently, one of Scottish football's best referees, Craig Thompson. I'll come to you, Joe. Having played Sunday football with you in the past, I know that you're a big fan of refereeing decisions, or poor ones at that. What was your take on Thompson's performance on Saturday? Because it was one of those games, I think you can really tell when a referee has been particularly poor, when both sets of fans are slating them, and slating them, you know, in a quite a neutral fashion. I think a lot of Kilmarnock fans would accept that it was really, really terrible for both teams, and I think most Motherwell fans would say the same.
Well, the only good thing I think he done on Saturday was sending Lee Clark off, because it led to the entertaining passage of him going round every single seat in the stand before deciding which one to sit on. Other than that, I think he was pretty dreadful. I thought it was strange that he booked Carroll McHugh for that challenge. Thought it was, it looked as if it was, to me, it was a 50-50. I don't think either player really led with their elbow or done anything untoward in the challenge. They both, obviously, had a clash of heads. Both had to go off, but McHugh got booked for it. And if I'm right in saying, I also found that when everything was cleared and the players went off and everything, Kilmarnock didn't get a free kick for it, which I think it was a drop ball or something, which I found even more bizarre. And I know you might be accused me of being one-sided here, just going through the Motherwell bookings, but also Johnson getting booked for over-celebrating. I just couldn't fathom that. I mean, he didn't go into the stand. He was nowhere near any Motherwell fans because they were in the upper section. And not only that, the other 10 outfield players joined him. So I don't see if Johnson gets booked, surely he needs to book all of them. That was bizarre. There were just so many things that a typical kind of Craig Thompson performance, that he just slowed down the game with petty fouls everywhere. I didn't think the Kilmarnock penalty shout had much substance to it. But I mean, as you say, both sets of fans were pretty annoyed with him, so he can't have had a good game.
Well, maybe Bust will be able to confirm this. I'm not sure, because I completely forgot to check. But I saw some chat on Pian Bovril, I think it was, about the McHugh challenge, and about whether or not he had actually went through with the booking. I know at the game, we obviously saw him get his card out and things like that. But I saw some chat about the fact that he might have changed his mind. I don't know what is worse in that regard, because I think that, as you say, you know, you watch it back, there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever that it's a clash of heads. You know, it's not a foul, it's not a booking. But Thompson's immediate reaction to get the card out can be nothing other than a reaction to the Kilmarnock fans responding to it. You know, there was chance of, you know, some of the Kilmarnock fans seemed to want him sent off for what was a head knock, and yet Thompson was straight out with the card because he was influenced by the fans. And then if he's then decided not to book him, which again, you know, I think I've just read, I'm not sure, Buster might have more insight, but if he then decides not to book him, presumably because he's seen the hole in McHugh's head, surely even that shows that he's quite a, you know, quite a poor referee, that he doesn't have the convictions to actually make his own decisions and stand by them. But I don't know, Buster, if you've read the same, or whether you can remember if he actually got booked or not.
I don't know, to be honest with you, because I remember at the time, you know, it was a clash of heads, as you says, but I remember at the time thinking McHugh was, I don't want to say reckless, because that's not really what I mean, but he was maybe just a fraction sort of slow in getting there, and a bit sort of robust in the way he went in for it. And I think if you go in like that when you're on your feet, you know, in a normal sort of challenge, you know, you get a foul against you and you get a booking. I don't really, you know, I don't really know. I'd have to see it again, to be honest. I've not watched it back. So if that's what actually happened, you know, and he did get booked, fair enough. I'm sorry, I'm actually just looking to see if he actually did get booked while we're chatting here, but I don't know if he did. I remember at the time thinking as well, he didn't know which way he was going to give a foul, if he was going to give a foul, and he wasn't sure what he was actually doing. As Joe says as well, until Joe started talking about what had actually, you know, what players had been booked for and things like that, I wasn't even sure of any major things that he was, you know, the major calls he'd made. But I remember after the game, obviously we went down to talk to the Kamarnock lads and that, and the two sets of fans were just basically moaning about the fact that he was pretty shite. But the Johnson one as well, that was unreal, to be fair. As I'm looking here again, just as I click through it there, McHugh apparently did get booked. So again, I'd have to see it again before I thought it was too much or too wild a decision. But at the time, I thought, you know, he was a wee bit slow, and you know, he came in a bit hard, basically. And you can't really just throw your head in there. I know people will say, well, he has to go for the ball, which is quite fair. But I thought it was maybe just a wee bit. Again, I don't want to say rough because that's not what I mean. But you know, I thought it was there was a possibility that it could have been a foul.
No, fair enough. If he was booked, then. You know, fair enough. I did actually just have a check while you were talking there as well. But I'd read some of the chat about maybe he wasn't booked or maybe he was. I think that was obviously just the confusion caused by the fact that he went off injured. But we'll move on to last night. We kind of have to, unfortunately. I think we were meant to record this earlier in the week, and for some reason we decided we'd wait until the night after the Celtic game, which has turned out to be not the best idea. I think we were a wee bit more optimistic when we made that decision. I don't know about you guys, in the build-up to it, I was feeling reasonably optimistic. I still obviously recognise that going to Celtic Park is going to be a massive, massive ask, particularly this season, because I think that, you know, although Brendan Rodgers was getting a few pelters for not going out and buying loads of players, I think some of the players, particularly Scott Sinclair, you know, will absolutely stroll this division, so it was going to be a big ask to go there. But I just felt with the likes of Griffiths and Toure missing out, and you know, maybe a wee bit renewed optimism around the squad, a one-off game we could go and maybe try and you know, utilise Johnson and Ainsworth or whatever and take advantage of the big park. You know, I was feeling quite optimistic. I'd stuck a few quid on us at 12-1. And then I saw the lineup, and I think that, for me, says it all. I saw the lineup and was pessimistic, and then I saw that we'd went 3-5-2, and you know, I decided we were doomed after about 30 seconds of the game. I'm not sure what your guys' reactions. I mean, Joe, you know, that was my thoughts on it. I think it's important to recognise that, because it's easy to have a rant, as and many have, about McGee and about the players and things like that, and the way we've set up with hindsight and after the game. But when you're doing it before the ball's even been kicked, when up until that point you were quite optimistic. I think that says a wee bit more about some of the decisions that are being made by the manager in terms of lineup, in terms of tactics, in terms of setup. I mean, what was your take before the match, both before you knew the team and then after?
Well, to be honest, I thought that we were going to have another night of 4-3-3 with Joe Chalmers as a central midfielder. When I first seen it, and then it wasn't until they kind of put the lineup graphic on BT that it really made me realise we're playing a back three or a back five or whatever way you want to look at it. To me, last night, it's a case of, I think we were beaten by a good Celtic side last night, heavily beaten at that, whereas the last time it was a Motherwell side that were already on the beach, failed to turn up, etc. So there are major differences. The one thing I think we were talking about, defensive errors and slips and everything last night, but I just felt that the way we set up last night led us into kind of relentless Celtic attacks, and it was going to be that way, the way we set up, how deep we were sitting, and there's only so many balls you can defend without making a mistake when it's coming so quickly. So I think us going there and playing that formation really made me think that it wasn't going to be our night, especially when you look at the two wing-backs. We haven't seen a great deal of Tate just now to be able to comment one way or another. But I thought against Kilmarnock, he actually looked like he was going to be more of an asset going forward than he would defensively. But he just never seemed to get out last night. And then Chalmers at the other side, I think if you play that formation, you need a wing back that's going to kind of get up and down. But he was the same. It was definitely more a back five than a back three. And I mean, you're only inviting pressure when you play against a team of good footballers, and they're only going to punish you in a formation like that. And I mean, I just as much with the best will in the world, I just do not rate Joe Chalmers, and I'm a big McGee fan, as most of you know. I think he's done a really good job since he came in at Motherwell, but one thing that's griped me over the summer is he seems to be trying to shoehorn Joe Chalmers in as a kind of first replacement kind of guy, no matter where it is. I mean, we've seen him essentially play three or four different positions now already this season, and unfortunately there hasn't really been anything in any of those performances to tell me it could even be a short term option there. So that kind of made me a bit disappointed in our selection last night. And it was only when we kind of brought on Ainsworth at half time that we kind of looked as if we were going to do anything. We didn't have any kind of like urgency about our play to get out. I just thought last night we were beaten by a very good team, but we brought it on a lot ourselves by the negative approach we went there with.
Buster, I mean, what's your take on it? I mean, obviously Joe's kind of summed it up for me, I think, in terms of, as I said before, I think I kind of thought that was us. I'd went from being ridiculously optimistic to being convinced we were going to get hammered just within about 2 minutes of the start of the game. It looked as though we were defending a one-goal lead with 5 minutes to go, rather than being in a one-off cup tie that has to be settled on the night. We didn't offer anything really. We had the odd spell going forward, but just the way we defended, the way we set up, we basically took to the park either looking for the most ridiculously lucky 0-0 and then what, possibly nick it on penalties. Surely that's not a game plan you can actually go into a cup tie with. But do we need to, you know, just accept that Mark McGee's going to do these things? Or, I mean, Joe mentions Joe Chalmers as well. He talks about him shoehorning Chalmers into the team. We've seen him try to kind of shoehorn other players into certain positions and it hasn't worked. You know, Marvin Johnson at left back, Louis Lang at defensive mid. Do we just need to accept that Mark McGee, for all his good points and for as good a manager he is just going to be, you know, susceptible to a bit of a mind fuck when it comes to decisions every so often? Or do we have a right to be disappointed in decisions on a night like last night?
Well, I don't think they necessarily shouldn't go hand in hand. You know, everybody's every right to be disappointed. But I think when it comes to these sort of games against Celtic, you have to try things, maybe catch them out. You have to rely on a lot of luck. Unfortunately, though, when you do try things and they don't work, it falls down in a bad way. Was there, you know, would I probably have preferred us to go maybe a 4-5-1, you know, with the two wingers help them out defensively, a bit more defensively than they usually would, rather than, you know, Johnson and Ainsworth, whatever, being up front? Of course I would have. I don't think it would have been right for us to go 4-3-3 and go for it, because we'd probably get tanked 5-0 then as well. And, you know, the questions would have been asked about whether or not we should have been playing a bit tighter, you know, doing things a different way. It's one of those things where Mark McGee, he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't. I think it's just with McGee especially, because I think there's still people who obviously don't like him and are just waiting for things to fall apart basically so they can get him on. I think though, again, as you say, it's a very good Celtic team. Well, they looked a very good Celtic team last night, at least anyway. You know, they've had their critics about it being, you know, one of the worst Celtic teams in a while, but if you look through their squad, they've got guys who sat on their bench last night, like Christie, Armstrong, Chifty, who, you know, when they were playing with other teams, were basically the best players in the other teams, Dundee United, Inverness, whoever it was. You know, and they'd probably walk into your teams as well. You can quite rightly be disappointed. There's no way I'm saying you know MD can nobody's got the right to be disappointed, but it's one of those things where these things are going to happen. They signed, as you say, Scott Sinclair, you know, was it Saturday there or something, £4.5 million. It wouldn't surprise me if that's 4.5 times your budget for the year. So it's no surprising, but it's disappointing to see when we're doing like that. In regards to the setup as well, you know, they were obviously playing Sinclair and James Forrest wide. I don't really think, you know, sort of two attacking wing backs against two guys who are going to sit in these spaces would have been a bright idea either. But as I say, it's no one where I'm going to sit and think about it for weeks. You know, we get pumped, end of, let's move on. You know, we'll get bigger and better games to come up, and probably ones that will, over the season, mean more to us than a one-off, you know, 5-0 defeat in the cup.
Oh no, I completely understand. I completely get that. I mean, I agree. At the end of the day, a 5-0 doing in the League Cup at Celtic Park doesn't define your season. The odds were always stacked against us, but you know, as I suppose my question is, I understand what you're saying about fans kind of waiting in the wings to have a go at them. I sometimes feel as though we sometimes go too far either way. You know, we're kind of getting into a murky water where there are people who are too quick to have a go at him because he's Martin McGee, but then there are those who are too quick to dismiss that criticism as people having a go at him because he's Martin McGee. There is a fine balance in the middle, and I think that, you know, for all these good things that he's done, I think he is, you know, capable of perhaps thinking himself too good a tactical genius or trying to, you know, do something out the box that just never works. I mean, there is a list starting to form where Mark McGee has changed tactics or played players in positions that he shouldn't have, and we've been absolutely torn to shreds. And these are games, you know, Tynecastle, you know, Celtic, these are games that I think most Motherwell fans would have identified that before a ball was kicked, and did. You know, the joy of having social media and forums and all this kind of thing now is that fans can have their opinions out there before the game started, and I think we're seeing on quite a infrequent but still a noticeable basis that Mark McGee makes bizarre changes, overly negative changes, overly elaborate changes that most fans can see before a ball's kicked aren't going to work. But I suppose my question is, if that is the case, whether you personally agree with that or not, if there are fans that think that is the case, is that just symptomatic of having a good SPL manager? You know, we talk about guys like Lionel Ainsworth. He's great on his day, but he's inconsistent. Well, because he's inconsistent, we get him. Because if he was great on his day all the time, he'd be doing the Premiership. Is that just what we've got to accept, that Mark McGee, you know, is a great manager at this level, but if he wasn't susceptible to, you know, doing absolutely stupid things, he just wouldn't be Motherwell manager?
Again, a bit of yes and no. If, you know, as you say, if he was doing it a lot more frequently and it was costing a lot more points, and, you know, we didn't do, for example, last season, he done it at Ross County. I think Johnson played left back one day when we were up in Dingwall. We got trounced 2-3-0. You know, but then normal sort of, when the normal service resumed after that, you know, we won a few games. We finished fifth after, you know, as close as maybe the end of January, sitting sort of 4 or 5 points ahead of Dundee United in second bottom. As you say, it's one of those things where, do we have to just sit back and accept it? Or, you know, as fans, I suppose, we really actually do have to just sit back and accept whatever's there, because we don't have any way of actually changing it. Don't, obviously, you know, if things were terrible, you could protest or whatever and stuff like that. But I mean, on the day, if you go to the football on Saturday and Stevie Hamill's playing centre forward for some reason, you just have to accept that and hope it works out. But what you're really hoping for is that Mark McGee learns for these things. You know, we've had people on saying he's a really intelligent guy. He's, you know, he knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's doing. And I don't doubt that. But as you say, there's one or two things where he maybe tries a bit too hard, and it obviously doesn't work out. But you know, there's going to be one time where we turn up at Fir Park and Stevie Hamill is playing centre forward and he scores a hat trick. So again, it's one of those things. But I don't know. I don't think there's a yes or no answer to that, to be fair. But it's I don't really know, to be honest with you.
Well, seeing Sparrow's not here, because he'd have been having none of that Stevie Hamill chat. Moving on to the players, you know, we're having a wee bit of a go, or well, at least I'm probably having a bit of a go at Mark McGee. You know, I said earlier about how good I thought the likes of Tate and Hennigan were looking, but last night was perhaps a wake-up call for them. Quite a poor defensive performance, I thought. I think that I agree entirely. I think both of you made the comment that we're playing a very good Celtic side, and someone like Scott Sinclair was always going to be a handful and a threat. But for me, if you're going to be paying a professional footballer who plays at the back a wage, there are certain basics that they need to be able to do, you know, positioning, decision making, marking, closing down, organisation. And there were times last night where players were out of position, they weren't marking, they were losing their man, and quite frustratingly at times they were just standing off and made it so easy for Celtic. I mean, as I said before, Scott Sinclair will romp this league, but he will especially romp it if he's playing against defences that just stand and watch him. I mean, last night, regardless of how good his team Celtic were and how off we were, I think the final, 20 shots on target to one. I mean, I don't care what level you're at or who you're playing, that is a really, really shocking statistic. You know, Buster mentioned earlier about the fact that, you know, a night like last night, if your luck isn't in, then, you know, you're going to struggle. I think our luck was in, only to lose 5-0. And I mean, that kind of sums up the defensive performance for me. I mean, Joe, you're obviously a defender by trade. I mean, what was your take watching the defensive performance from Motherwell last night, even although they were up against a top side?
It just really annoyed me that we never seemed to get out. Like, it seemed that we would clear the ball and there was no real kind of effort to get up the pitch. You know that obviously falls with other areas in the pitch and was perhaps up front or whatever, but we made no kind of attempt to come out, and we just kind of seemed to be the cycle of we'd win our tackles or win our headers, we'd clear the ball, hit it to Celtic, and they'd start again. That's, I mean, it's a mistakes are bound to happen then, because if you're just doing something relentless over and over again, you're bound to have momentary lapses or switch off or whatever. So, you know, that just really frustrated me. The one bit in particular that I had a gripe with had to be the award of the penalty. I mean, I've seen Motherwell fans on social media, Steelman online, whatever, saying that it was a soft penalty and, well, typical Celtic at home getting a penalty like that. But for me, you won't see a more Stonewaller penalty all season, pretty much. I mean, yeah, just because he didn't knock him over or he didn't hit him hard, it was incredibly naive. And I mean, he let Sinclair get the wrong side of him. The first thing he should try to do was kind of get square with him so he couldn't hide him without being there. And the way Sinclair was going, he wasn't going to turn and cross it. Tate's position was good enough that Sinclair couldn't turn and shoot right away without turning into him. He couldn't cross it. So what he felt the need to put his hand in his back for is absolutely beyond me. And I mean, I think that just came at a time where I had the potential to kind of kill the game off for us. And I was just really disappointed that, yeah, you're playing against a £5 million player, it's always going to be difficult, but, I mean, you do the basics right, you make it as hard as possible for him. If he beats you with a great piece of skill, then fair enough. If he beats you with a moment of magic, then fair enough. If he beats you with raw pace. But it's when it's something that you do recognise as being defendable against, that just really disappointed me. That was my main gripe to take away for the game.
It's interesting you mentioned the penalty, or at least the reaction to it. I mean, I've not done a lot of reading on Steelman Online and things like that today about the penalty. But yeah, for me, it was an absolute stonewaller. I'm surprised anybody can dispute that was a penalty. And in fact, I couldn't, as much as I love Stevie Craigan and I think Chris Sutton is an absolute weapon, I couldn't help but cringe during the commentary last night when the two of them were arguing about the penalty and Craigan was suggesting it was soft. I mean, for me, it was a stonewaller. We'll just finish on the game by giving Buster the last word here. Penalty or no penalty?
Penalty, but I do think it was soft. I'm in no way doubting it was a penalty, but what Joe said is 100% correct. You know, he was beaten far too easy. But I think that, you know, that was when he kicked it in the direction he was going, and he seen what was happening. As soon as Tate stuck his arm out, he's like, yes, you know, he thought he'd won the lottery. Basically, as soon as that arm came out, he thought, that comes anywhere near me and I'm going down. And don't get me wrong, I don't think it was not so soft that it was debatable or anything, but I can see, for example, Stevie Craigan's point. But again, it was a penalty, I think.
Well, we'll move on for last night, thankfully. Bit of transfer chat going on this week. Firstly, Craig Clay obviously signing up in a 2-year deal. It seemed to be between him and Lucas. I'm not sure just how much the injury to Lucas has played a part, you know, and the competition, if you like, between the two. I know Lucas was on the bench last night, so it'll be interesting to see if he is still in with a shout of signing. But Clay, I mean, for me, he's looked decent enough. He's certainly not looked out of place in the middle of the park. A wee bit concerned that, from what I've seen, I think he looks more in the kind of tough tackling defensive mould. That might just be the role he's been playing, or, you know, just the way things have happened. I think we were missing maybe a wee bit more of an attacking midfielder that can maybe slot in alongside Lasley and McHugh. But I mean, Joe, what's been your kind of take on Clay so far, and is a 2-year deal for him a good signing?
I'm content with his signing. I don't think I'm absolutely delighted with signing him. I think he's been a decent acquisition, but at the same time, I wouldn't have been that disappointed had we not, based on what I've seen so far. And I mean, it's probably not as much a slight on the player as you say is the type of player. I see him possibly signing more in the mould that will allow us to rotate Lasley if we so need to. I mean, Lasley, although he's nearly 37, for me, we're only having this debate here because he is nearly 37. He's adapted his game, and he's not showed any signs to me that he wouldn't be able to play 40 times this season if required. But given his age, I think there might be a view of that in it. I mean, I looked at his statistics, and he doesn't seem to have over Grimsby and other places down south. He doesn't seem to have chipped in anywhere near the goals that Pearson scored last season for us. So I wouldn't put him in the team there as a like for like. Maybe McGee wants to try a slightly different system or a different way of playing his midfield. And I mean, it's possibly worth noting that when McGee's first spell, Stephen Hughes had a fantastic first season for us, playing an attacking midfield role, and he only scored once. So being an attacking midfielder doesn't necessarily just mean goals. It will be interesting to see how it develops. It does leave us kind of in the kind of tough tackling defensive midfielders, if that does prove to be his position. We are very well covered there. And from what I've seen of Cadden, he does have a lot of the attributes that we had from Pearson. I mean, he gets himself into the box, he gets himself into good positions, he makes goals, he's scored a few already this season. So in terms of replacing Pearson, I don't think Clay is that type of player. But in terms of maybe balancing the squad a bit better, if McGee sees Cadden is more of the player to step into Pearson's shoes, then that's fair enough. It also gives us options. If we play Cadden more centrally, that means we can maybe fit Ainsworth and Johnson into the same team, depending on who we're playing. It gives us a number of options. So, all in all, I think he's a decent signing, and we'll see how it pans out from what I've seen so far.
See, I agree with pretty much all of that, but the one thing I can't help get frustrated by, and I know you didn't kind of go too much or really labour the point too much and skirted over it a little bit, but you know, the idea that we even need to mention Keith Lasley's age, I just find bizarre. I mean, I've seen absolutely nothing for Keith Lasley to suggest that he is any less fit or any less capable of lasting a season than anyone else in the team. When you consider nowadays how much of it is based around how well you take care of yourself, how much of a professional you are, there could be arguments there that there'll be young players in the under-20s who are less fit and less able to last the season, or there probably are plenty of them, than Keith Lasley, and yet we probably wouldn't have a discussion about how we need to bring in or have a player there to, you know, rotate with a young player. I just find it such a bizarre thing. It seems as though because some of our players get to, you know, past 33 or 34 or some age, suddenly that leaves them open to be replaced or rotated, and I just don't see it at all. You know, there are players who actually move from more attacking positions into Keith Lasley's position because it allows them to extend their career. You know, Ryan Giggs, for example, obviously dropped more centrally. Even Wayne Rooney, who's a bit younger, seems to be dropping back into a more kind of central role because he doesn't have the legs to do it quite as much. I just don't get it. I don't understand why Keith Lasley's age has to be mentioned so much.
See, generally, I would agree with you. And as I said in the previous kind of chat there, I was saying that the reason his age has been mentioned is because it's his age. It's not because I have any concern over it. It's just because there is this sort of stigma that a professional footballer should be aged 17 to 35. I mean, I haven't seen much to say that he can't be an effective player for 40 games of the season. However, if they said to me, based on last season, could he have been an effective 40 games a season if he was playing in a midfield three with Stephen Pearson and Liam Grimshaw or Chris Cadden? Yes. Could he have been an effective player if he was playing 40 games in a season alongside Jake Taylor? No. So you have to balance that. When he was in the team alongside Jake Taylor last season, sorry for mentioning that name again, but there were games that I thought Lasley was trying to do far too much. And I mean, it's not a criticism as such, but I just didn't think that he had it in him at age 35 to do as much as he needed to do for someone beside him who clearly wasn't interested. And I'm fairly sure that the likes of Carroll McHugh and Jake Taylor aren't going to be those kind of players. If anything, they look pretty much the opposite from what I've seen so far. Both like to get stuck in, and both seem like they like to be involved. So I don't have those major concerns, but I think Lasley had a very good season last season, but we had to recognise what role we had to use him in, and we had to use him that way. We definitely did. I mean, it's not as if we could have said the season where he got five goals for midfield, 2011-2012. I mean, that season he covered every blade of grass. He was going box to box. He has to adapt himself to be a more holding player now, and he's great at it, but it depends on those around him performing as well. For me, that was mainly why I mentioned it.
Well, see, I would just like to say that as well, because we spoke about this the other night, and basically what Joe has just said there is why I think this even came into the conversation, or why it's even, not the conversation, sorry, why this has come into people's minds, because when Keith Lasley was playing with people who were effectively no there, he was running box to box, left to right, and had to try and do it all himself. And, you know, maybe at that point he was blowing out his arse or whatever, but that was when people, in my opinion, that was when that was started to get brought up. Oh, Keith Lasley's new 35, 36, 37, whatever. That was the reason that started to get brought up, because he was playing in there with invisible men, basically. Once, you know, it settled down a bit and we got a couple of midfielders in there again, I don't think there was any sort of problem. As you said as well, there, Joe, when he's playing with people who know their role and play their role as well, there's no problem. But it seems to have been since, you know, he was playing in midfield with himself effectively, that's where this age thing was then brought up. But much like Jay, you know, he seems perfectly fit, and fine. So it's not as if he's going to retire in October. He'll be here for the rest of the year. I don't see much problem with it, but as you say, it's always good to have, you know, more than one option. So we'll see what's what.
Aye, and obviously, if he's listening, I'm sure he'll be delighted that he was mentioned, you know, compared to Wayne Rooney and Ryan Giggs earlier on. obviously, the other transfer kind of news, and let's be honest, we're basically going to talk about Marvin Johnson every podcast, pretty much every day, I think, until either the transfer window closes or he moves on. We obviously had Oxford, you know, floating around, seeming quite keen on him. I think, was it 300,000 seemed to be what they labelled as a very, very good offer. I think we'd all agree that it was nonsense. Brighton seemed to have entered into the fray. I'm not sure how much truth there is in it. I've not seen it confirmed anywhere that there was a £500,000 bid, but I do know that that was mentioned. I mean, Joe, what are the chances on Johnson? Everybody seems to have a bit of a different opinion here. I mean, are we going to hold on to him, or is it just basically a question of how much we get for him?
I'd like to think we would hold out for the right offer being there. We've put the kind of £1 million price bracket out there now, so I mean it wouldn't look good in the club if we ended up selling him for less than that. I think we need to be very careful about the fact he's, at the minute, he's got 2 years left in his contract. I reckon that length of contract on a player like him, I think his stock would be at its absolute highest if we got 6 months out of him, or 4 months, or whatever it is, until January just now, with him in the team, and he continued to play well. I mean, just now he's scored 4 goals in his first 6 games this season, I think it is, 6 or 7, 6 I think it is, which is a great start when you think about it, and you can see why teams are swarming around him. But at the same time, he has scored his goals this season and put his performances in majorly against lower league teams. I think if we held on to him until January and he was on 8 goals, 9 goals, and he'd been scoring them against Premier sides and putting in good performances and keeping the consistency up, then I think that would probably be the point where we could get most money for him. But at the same time, he has hit for him at the right time in terms of the September transfer window. And I think that if we do get an offer now, we have seen his consistency levels go up and down to an extent last season. Although I do think every time Motherwell played well last season, pretty much Marvin Johnson played well. We have seen his consistency go up and down a little bit, whereas just now he's on form, and if we get a good offer in, I would take it. I think the club are kind of actively trying to put him in the shop window for this window. I would just really like to think that it's not kind of, we need the money now, and if someone came in with 700,000 and on the last day of the month, then we would take it. I think Two years left in his contract, a player of his ability with all his attributes, I think we need to hold for him for £1 million. What the chances of that coming are, we don't really know behind the scenes. If Oxford felt like making a 300,000 bid was worth their while, then it means the valuations from other clubs might not be quite there. I'd like to see us holding for him, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, we'll move on for the transfers then to Saturday's game. You know, obviously last night there is maybe a wee bit of negativity, but I'm sure by the time Saturday comes we'll all be optimistic as usual. But Buster, how do we respond for last night then? I mean, obviously it was a one-off cup tie, and as we said earlier, there's no need for it to have a long-term effect or any serious impact on our season, but it was a bit of a doing. It was live on telly. I'd imagine there were a few players who left the park pretty embarrassed and pretty down. I mean, how do we react from that on Saturday?
I think we've just got to go back to our game. You know, come out with the usual sort of 4-3-3 that we expect basically every week. Hopefully, as you say, hopefully there was a lot of the players who were pretty embarrassed. Hopefully the coaching staff and the management team, you know, put them through their paces today and tomorrow, whatever. And hopefully, you know, they react positively to it, because I can assume it would be pretty easy to, you know, let these things go to your head, let your head, you know, let your head drop a bit. And, you know, St Johnstone are a decent team, so it'll be interesting to watch. I didn't actually see in their game against Aberdeen, but I'm kind of looking forward to seeing us playing a Premier League team. With all due respect to Kilmarnock, we knew they were in a bit of trouble, a bit of a shambles, if you want. So the first 80 minutes or whatever was a bit of an easy sort of time for Motherwell. But it'll be good to see, you know, if we are where we think we are. Obviously, the Celtic game, I think, has to be written off. Poor performance, you know, poor choices and formation and tactics, fair enough. But I think it has to be sort of written off, and the games against your likes of your St Johnstone's are where we're going to see where we are and see what our level is.
Well, that's that, isn't it, Joe? I mean, at the end of the day, it's easy to kind of look to Saturday, a home tie against St Johnstone, and maybe think that, you know, we're out of the woods in terms of the big, difficult game of the week. But St Johnstone will certainly be a difficult challenge. A good point against Aberdeen in the opening day of the season. They obviously beat Hearts last night in the Cup. So there you go, there's two of the teams that I've expected to be in the top four or possibly three. I mean, this is going to be a really difficult game.
Absolutely. I mean, they beat us three times last season, St Johnstone, and they're also... I was looking at the squads of the teams in the league the other day. They're one of few sides who haven't really lost anyone that would cause you any great concern, where at the same time they've added a couple of good players. I mean, they've managed to get Blair Alston from Falkirk, who's a promising wide player, and they also get Paul Payton from Dundee United, who at this level I'd imagine will do well for them. And I mean, you looked at their team in Wotherspoon, I'm sure hit double figures in goals for them last season, if I remember correctly. Yeah, he's only been in the bench for a couple of the games so far this season, and Danny Swanson seems to be on form and scoring for them. So yeah, they certainly will present a challenge for us, but I think we've got a good team, we've got good players, and it'll be a lot different in terms of tactics, mentality, to how I hope we'll go into it compared to how we went into the game last night. So there's no reason why we shouldn't be going there trying at home to get the 3 points.
Well, we're pretty much covered everything, so we'll just finish off with what changes you would make for Saturday, if any, and how you see the game going. Buster, what about yourself, line-up and prediction?
Well, I think we'd probably have to go back to basically what it was against Kilmarnock. Put in Ainsworth for Joe Chalmers and go 4-3-3 again. I think that's basically... I don't really know if there's any other options either, to be fair, but that's what I would do. And prediction-wise, as I say, I've not really seen St Johnstone, so on a bit of blind faith, I'll just say 2-1 Motherwell.
What about yourself, Joe?
I would probably keep the team that Buster's just mentioned, same as last week. If Carol McHugh's fit, I would be tempted to take Clay out the team,
yeah,
and play McHugh alongside Lasley, and there. That would probably be the only thing different. I'm going to say it's a game that have goals in it. I think both teams will score. I'm going to go with 2 each.
Fair enough. Well, I'm going to take a bit from each of you. I'll take Joe's team with the possibility of McHugh, and I'll say 2-1. So I'll agree with Buster there. Buster, you're in Vegas next week, so hopefully you'll be joining us in the podcast in a drunken haze for a casino somewhere.
Well, depending on what day it is and what time, I'll be 8 hours behind you, so I'll probably just be either getting in or getting up, so aye, one of them.
Well, cheers, Buster and Joe, for your company this evening.
No bother, thanks very much, Sparra.
No worries, thanks for having us, Sparra.
You've been listening to the MFC podcast. We'll be back next week, hopefully with Buster all the way from the States. Enjoy Saturday, hope for 3 points. Cheers.
I was 8 years old, been running with a dime in my hand, to the bus stop to pick up a paper from my old man. Sit on his lap, and I've been Santé, good look around. This is your hometown. This is your hometown. This is your hometown. This is your hometown. In 65, tension was running high at my school. There was a lot of fights between the black and white. There was nothing cars in a line on a Saturday night. In the backseat there was a gun. Words are past, shotgun blast. Troubled times they come in my hometown. In my hometown. In my hometown. In my now Main Street's whitewashed windows and vacant stores. Seems like there ain't nobody wants to come down here no more. They're closing down the textile mill across the railroad tracks. Foreman says these jobs are going, boys, and then your hometown, to your hometown, to your hometown, to your hometown. Last night me and Kay, we laid in bed, talking about getting out, packing up. Airbags maybe heading south. 35, we got a boy of our own now. Last night I sat him up behind the wheel, said something.